It's now time to turn to IDFA, and our roving reporter, Alexander Moost, has got some stars in the studio. We have Peter J. Brown and Lon Haber. Morning, guys. Morning, Alexander.
Good morning. Morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning, guys. You just drove here with a cab. I picked you up downstairs, and you're really, what is it, 8 o'clock, 5 minutes past 8. You're in Amsterdam, and yesterday you had your first screening of a film called Confessions of an Eco-Terrorist at IDFA Festival, International Documentary Festival in Amsterdam. How was it?
Well, it seemed to go great. You know, we the people seemed to like it, and we had a long question and answer after the end, and, you know, there was actually some difficult questions.
Yeah?
Which is unusual. Well, I don't know, people just need to know what's going on and what they can do and how it, you know, how everything can change. I mean, my film's an environmental film, but it's more an attitude film. It's, you know, it shows that a positive attitude can change anything, really. It could be the environment, it could be something local around where you live, and that's basically trying to get people off their couches and into the, to doing something.
So, just to get one thing straight, you're not a terrorist.
Well, no, well, I'm sitting here and I don't see any police officers around me. Mm-hmm. Actually, the terrorists are out there killing the oceans and destroying biodiversity. We're conservationists, but who would go to a movie, Confessions of a Conservationist?
Lon, what do you have to say about this peculiar and outstanding film? Because I received your film a week ago, and I beamed it at home. I was very happy to receive it. Thanks a lot. What do you think a general audience would make of this film in Amsterdam?
Well, in Amsterdam and so far elsewhere, it's quite a groundbreaking documentary because it's not exactly what people expect, you know? And, I mean, it's a really important issue. It's one of the most important issues. It's the future of our world and our planet and our ecosystem. But it's told from the point of view of an insider who also has a very uplifting look and, you know, wants to spread a positive message that the environment is able. So, you know, so the reason that audiences, I think, are tending to love it so much is because you leave there feeling good, and even though it's a serious subject matter with some, you know, pretty dire circumstances, you laugh a lot, and at the end you really feel like you can do something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was your first motive, Peter, to join the Sea Shepherd? Because, of course, we're talking about, maybe you just, you know, go through the synopsis and go through the script just a little bit.
Oh, well, 30 years ago, 35 years ago almost now, I got hired to do a job on filming Paul Watson. I work in the television business. I'm a television director.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Japan, did the job. Paul left. I got arrested. From then on, I was hooked.
So, you were arrested for filming, or you were arrested?
Well, they were arrested for being there, that they didn't know what I was doing. I mean, they had to let me off. Yeah, I was filming. They said I didn't have permission to film. I was a tourist. No, I wasn't. I was a news guy. I mean, we had a lot of little fights. They let me go, ultimately. But I got sold. You know, Paul Watson and I had similar ideas on just about everything.
Paul Watson is the
he's one of the founders of Greenpeace. Paul Watson, the subject mostly of my movie. Paul Watson and Bob Hunter pretty much were the two founders of Greenpeace. And so we got on, and they needed someone to take their picture. And I'm a storyteller, and God knows their stories. So for 30 years, I just followed them around as friends and gave away the footage for all these years.
Yeah.
And just recently, I cut this little film, you know, my own film, just because I had something to say.
Mike and Sander, what did you make of, because you've only seen the trailer.
But I've only seen the trailer. It looks like a great story. I mean, I'm from New Zealand, so we like to think we're pretty on top of a lot of these sort of issues. And you know, the French came. We were talking about the Rainbow Warrior a couple of weeks ago, and the French came and committed an act of terrorism against our eco warriors, the Rainbow Warrior. So yeah, it's a very interesting narrative, and looking forward to having a chance to see it.
So are you going to, you know, buy a ticket and
absolutely.
Mine?
I mean, I think
one for your girlfriend.
I think this morning we're already sold out because I don't see tickets available. So just to recap, what, you know, because listeners who are listening to this narrative, they'll be wanting to get along. There's three more opportunities to see this in the Documentary Film Festival Amsterdam. They can see it this morning at 10 a.m. That's kicking off in just under 2 hours. That's at Munt 11. Then you can see it on Tuesday or Thursday next week, and that's your only opportunity. And I think the tickets for today are already gone. So it's making an impact.
But I think this film will be picked up by Dutch TV. I mean, you know, we have the Dutch series on the Nederland 2 and Nederland 3.
There are a number of Dutch actors in it, actually, on the Faroe Islands. A number of them came whose names I don't remember other than Kim.
Well, Kim van Koten was in it. Kim van Koten joined your ship, and I tried to get her on the phone, but I couldn't.
Yeah, well,
I mean, if you have her mobile number, we can call her straight. You know, we can call her up and have coffee on the radio.
If I had it, I'd do it. But I mean, this is 10 years ago now that I was here. Actually, more than 12 years ago. So I've kind of forgotten even who they were, other than her, because she was. I made her kind of a little part in the movie.
Yeah, we actually had also Tom Hoffman.
Tom Hoffman, yeah.
And Victor Lowe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there were two comedians.
So why did they join and what did they do on your ship?
Well, this was the campaign, this particular thing was against the Faroe Island whale kill, the pilot whale kill, which happens every summer. And the ship started from Amsterdam here. And in any kind of environmental action, it's always good to get celebrity involved. And these particular Dutch celebrities volunteered to go, so we took them, and they did a great job. They were there, their presence was there. We actually stopped the whale kill that year. They didn't kill a whale while we were there, and so it was relatively successful. Even the two comedians got arrested because we sent them to shore in a rubber ducky, you know, a rubber raft. First time Faroes have ever been invaded since World War II. Mm-hmm. By a couple of Dutch comedians.
Yeah.
It was fascinating.
And that didn't make the film, but
they were indicted with what, Peter?
No, I think they were just deported. Oh, they were illegal entry into Faroe Islands is what they were arrested for. And them and there were two other, there was a Sea Shepherd person on that boat. And then there was a Dutch reporter whose name I forget went with them also. Four guys in this little rubber boat as the tide was going out. I really didn't give them much chance to even make it. But they did and got all the newspapers. And that's what we were doing. You know, we create press so that people pay attention to what's going on. And, you know, we're a small group, Sea Shepherd, but it's everybody that can stop things. But we just have to make, you know, like an acupuncture needle. We stick it in, and then when people take charge and say what's going on, they do something about it.
You just said that you had a Q&A, so a question and answer session after the first screening yesterday?
Yes, sir.
And there were some... Well, don't call me sir.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, sir. It's like an honor. Right. Okay. It's like ship talk.
American,
you know? Like, yes, sir. Sure. You got
these Americans.
I was brought up in New England,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
We have manners where I was brought up.
Exactly. You can call me sir if you
okay,
want.
Okay, I'll call you sir.
You got manners, and that's why you're on the Sea Shepherd, right? So.
Well, I always politely ask them to stop fishing before I whack them.
Yeah,
I'm sorry if I'm
no problem.
Yeah, so I just read on the ITVA website about the documentary, and it said there was a quote saying everything is allowed to protect the animals in the sea.
Well, that's might have been what it said there. Yeah. I thought no, everything's allowed except violence. You know, short of violence against human beings or animals, then anything's allowed.
So even violence.
Well, you know, if you call ramming a ship violent, then yes, that's violence. We call ramming a ship destroying a piece of gear that kills animals and innocent beings. So it would be like if you saw a tank running over a school bus and you stopped the tank. Is that violent?
Yeah.
I don't know. So that's just, you know, that's, you know, you can discuss that all day. I just didn't stop the whale killing.
Okay.
Let the future people discuss whether we were violent or nonviolent. And I think in the future, when it's looked at, if we humans are still around in 500 years, we aren't going to be the terrorists, you know. We're going to be the guys that everyone said, geez, they were doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I look at it.
Okay.
How do you look at it, Lon? What would the... difficult questions you just had yesterday. Are you also answering questions, or is it just Peter sitting there in front of like 1,000 people answering
exactly
the terrorist Peter. Questions?
Yeah,
you know?
Peter and 1,000 plus people.
Yeah,
answering questions.
What were the difficult questions for you? For you too?
For me? Well, I don't actually find any of the questions difficult because I answer them all, and I don't really have I don't have a group that I'm trying to say. I don't worry about what I say. I don't worry that my donors aren't going to give me money. I don't worry that I'm going to make somebody angry. So I just, when people ask me a question, I try to give them the best answer I can. And sometimes it's controversial, and sometimes it's not. I mean, so they're difficult when they ask why you do things. Well, gee, it's hard to know why you do things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could maybe do them for my children so they have whales around. I could maybe do them because it makes me feel good. I've been doing it so long now, I just kind of do it because it needs to be done. I mean, really, it's coming to that with me, you know.
How would you describe the style of your film, the genre?
Well, it's a bit mixed. I don't know, you know. I'm mostly a television director, And this film, there's, you know, cameramen from all over. My stuff is the beautifully sharp, high def film. You know, the stuff of me is people's home cameras, or, you know, anybody that might have had. I had a hard time finding footage of actual me and, you know, that people might have shot or whatever. So it's, I don't know, it's a story. That's how I describe it. And people seem to get charged up and come out smiling.
Yeah, okay, but it also has sort of like a tacky edge to it. You presented more as, I wouldn't say like a, hey guys, it might be perceived as sort of like, hey, this is a cult or a camp kind of attitude thing in
well,
the beginning.
You know, you can't and get then, any message across unless you entertain people. I mean, The Cove is a perfect example of a film that won an Academy Award. They spent more money on their credits than I spent on their whole film, probably. Yeah. And here's a film that really no one wants to go see. It's hard to watch. I've been in Taji. I know I have not sat through the film yet. I'm supposed to have, but I haven't. And it's very difficult to watch. I wanted to make a film that people would actually watch, they'd actually talk about, and they could discuss those issues also. You can, you know, bring up tough issues in a film like this. Yeah. Michael Moore did it with Unemployment and Roger and Me. And, you know, so it was a genre that's out there, I suppose. And people have done it with Super Size Me, eating whatever he ate, McDonald's or whatever it does. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you have, in order to make a point, you got to get people to watch. And, you know,
That's possibly the good part of the film, is that it you know, it takes a step aside and brings you to something that you wouldn't expect, and then it turns out to be very good. Like many of Moore's films, and, you know, I remember that scene in Seeing the Cove last year. Was it last year or 2 years ago?
Yeah, I think it was 2 years ago. Don't remember.
And it won a few awards around the world, but it was so fucking heavy.
Yeah, no one could watch it. I mean, it's really, I mean, I have some death in my film.
Sick.
But I try to lighten it up with lighter music. I mean, what I'm doing is trying to say that the people are out there who are, in my opinion, the terrorists, not me. I want them to watch the film and look at themselves and kind of say, boy, we look stupid. Maybe this isn't the right idea. I mean, no one eats whales anymore. We should, you know, this is, they're full of heavy metals. You know, our children are getting stupid. Gee, maybe it's time we stop whaling. Or seal hunting, the same thing. They can't sell the seal pelts anymore. They don't make any money. Why are they doing it? So I'm just trying to get people to take a different perspective and take a different look at these things. And maybe, you know, make the world a better place.
And they'd say their answer would be, well, because it's a tradition.
Yeah. Well, so is cannibalism. You know, there's been a lot of tradition. Headhunting, you know, taking scalps, tons of traditions out there that have gone by the wayside. And, you know, whaling is one. And it's not much of a tradition in Japan. You know, the United States started whaling after World War II in Japan.
Yeah.
So this doesn't go back that far.
Well, after we, you're going to sit in with us, but we're also going to talk to Doss Winkle, and Doss is one of those free fighters as well.
Yeah,
and
no, I've heard of him. I actually don't know him personally, but
well, that's great. You're going to meet on the air.
Oh, great.
And he's in Leiden, and we're going to ring him up.
We are. We certainly
we're gonna
are.
Take a little break after this.
We're just going to go to a tune. And first of all, Peter, I love your voice. Do you do a lot of radio?
Yeah, this.
You've got a great voice.
You know,
dude.
10 hours difference in time. You got me up in the middle of the night.
We're very sorry about that.
All right, this is director of Confessions of an Eco-Terrorist, Peter J. Brown, here live on The English Breakfast. We're going to go to a tune by Foster the People. Then we're going to come back and speak to Doss Winkle. How about that?
Great.
Sounds good.
Time is 25 past 8. You're listening to The English Breakfast. That is Foster the People and Call It What You Want. Now live online we have Doss Winkles. Morning, Doss.
Good morning.
Good morning, Doss. This is Alexander speaking for The English Breakfast Radio.
Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
Hello. Where are you now?
I am in Leiden, not far from Amsterdam, actually.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what is your business? What did bring... What
what brought
is your
me daily to Leiden?
Business in Leiden as an eco-activist, photographer? Maybe you should explain just a little bit about what you do, because Doss Winkle is quite well known in the Netherlands, and our friends here in the studio are people from the Sea Shepherd, And you've heard about them and you've worked with them probably.
Yes.
What are you doing, Dust, at the moment?
Well, my story started about 27 years ago. I was teaching in Aruba, orthopedic medicine. That's my profession. And then somebody asked me if I was interested in diving. And I said, yes, okay, why not? It's nice. And I got some instruction, not more than 5 minutes. And I dove for about 3/4 of an hour. And that changed my life. And to make a very long story short, I started a course, a dive course on the island of Bonaire, not far from Aruba. And then I dove all over the world, came back many times to the same places. And what I saw was... in the beginning, not so frightening, but then after a couple of years, I realized that the changes that I saw every time when I came back to the same spot were so tremendous that I started reading about all the possible threats to the oceans. I started to contact people, and now we have a network of many, many people. Scientists all over the world, from Australia to Canada, America, and I am an ocean activist. I try to protect the oceans with our NGO. We have an NGO now in Holland. It's the Sea First Foundation, and we go a little bit further than just protecting wildlife. We also warn people for the pollution, all the contaminants in the ocean. Think about the plastic soup, you may have heard about that. Mm-hmm. We also talk about animal welfare, because that's a big issue for us. Fish are treated like bricks, you know, like pieces of wood, like whatever you call it, without mm-hmm. any feelings. And that's very bad, because we know from the past 10 years, all the studies that have been done, more than 1,000 in the meantime, that fish are normal, well, normal for me, very special, animals that have a very well-developed central nervous system and peripheral nervous system, and that they do feel pain like we do, like dogs and cats and hawks and horses and whatever. And that they do have fear and stress, and we treat them like they're nothing.
Mm-hmm. One way for you to document everything you see is to, because you're also, and maybe you forgot to mention that in your introduction, you're a great photographer. You're an underwater photographer, and you have great shows, and you also published a lot of books on the most perfect and pristine places in the world, where all. You know, people who would go into diving would want to dive after you, but is that such a good idea?
No, that's not such a good idea. There are a few places left. Yes, I am an underwater photographer, and that has helped me, by the way, by showing all the beauty. That has helped me to make the people more aware about what we are losing at the moment. And, so many places where I went to, I won't go anymore, because it's not nice anymore. It's not beautiful. One example, we have lived on the island of Bonaire, where I did my first dive course, for about 10 years. And I used to dive in front of my home, because it was exactly on the seaside. And the first years, it was amazing. It was beautiful. But now, I could show you pictures, you know, before and after. It's nothing anymore. All the corals are dead. There is no coral reef left. And I've just come back from the Raja Ampat. That's West Papua. You know, that's the western half of the big island, New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
It belongs to Indonesia, although the West Papuans don't like that. But anyway, it does belong to Indonesia. It's one of the most pristine places on Earth. And even there, I've been there 4 times now, it is getting worse and worse. Coral reefs are dying. Not all the coral reefs. There are still pristine places, but
Maybe Peter wants to comment on it. Peter's sitting next to my.
Yeah, this is Peter. And
hi, Peter.
I kind of like to look at it as the planet Earth is a spaceship, and we humans are mere passengers on this ship. And
exactly.
As we go along, we're killing off the crew, and the crew are the people who keep the ship running, the bacteria, the fish
exactly.
in the oceans. And sooner or later, as I tell people, we passengers can either keep playing as the Titanic hits the iceberg, or we can go down below and see if we can patch a few holes. And I'd like to think of us as going down below and passing holes.
Yeah, I agree completely. Mm. Absolutely.
So we got to teach people that those things we think are inconsequential are actually keeping us alive, and that's a difficult thing to teach humans for some reason. I don't know why they don't get it.
Well, the thing is that maybe we have to touch the more sensitive part of people, and what we tell them is, listen, without the oceans, we can't survive. The oceans take up about somewhere, it depends on the different parts of the oceans, where there is more or less phytoplankton, you know, the plant-like plankton. They take up 50 to 70% of all the carbon dioxide. And they give us back 50 to 70% of all the oxygen. And we can't live without oxygen. And we are killing the oceans. The phytoplankton is getting less and less on many places on Earth. We know that by measurements that they've done via satellites and on the spot also. So what are we doing? You know, and if people realize that, then they start thinking differently. And another thing is that fish, for instance, people think of fish as very, very healthy for their health, which isn't true, because the seas are polluted more and more and more. There are dioxins, PCBs, heavy metals, and about 80,000 different chemical substances caused by plastic. So you find all that in fish.
Yeah.
And people are eating this.
Well, not only are people eating it, the pigs are the world's largest marine predator, a bit more than
exactly.
sharks. And the factory farms chickens in Denmark eat more puffins and fish than all the puffins in the world. I mean, they eat more fish than all the puffins in the world. So we
it's
have to stop
very good reason
feeding
to
our
a
cats
vegetarian.
And other things fish.
Yeah, it's true.
Thus, you also mentioned on your site, and I've seen a few interviews with you on internet, and I've met you one time in Amsterdam when you did this great show on the water photography right here around the corner at the Stopra.
That was a nice show,
That was nice, but the flip side of what you do is something else. You're advising people on what to eat, where to eat it, and when to eat it for their own benefit and health, and on the other hand, making sure that we don't kill the seas for a full 100%. At what level are we at this moment? Are we at 60%, 70%? Because I'm trying to make people just a little bit more aware of where we're going. You have more detailed information about some issues.
Yeah, but it's a very difficult question, you know, because we are advising people not to eat fish anymore. For the first reason is that fish is not healthy. Secondly, fish produce calcium carbonate. They take in calcium because there's a lot of calcium in the ocean. They take it in and what they poop out, that's calcium carbonate. And that's the buffer after the plants, of course, the plankton, the phytoplankton, and all the algae and the weeds, the seaweeds, is the buffer for calcium carbonate, for CO2, for carbon dioxide. And so we need to leave the fish in the oceans. That's one. Two, fish is not healthy anymore. It used to be healthy when the seas were clean and not polluted. and everybody is saying we need to eat fish because it's so healthy.
But you do advise people to eat sweetwater fish, right?
No. No, we don't. We advise people not to eat fish at all. Because sweetwater, freshwater, is also polluted. If you look at the eel, for instance, in Holland, the eels are so toxic that if you eat one portion of eel, which is about 150 grams, then you should become a vegan for at least 1.5 months to get rid of all the toxins.
Peter's got to say wants to say something about being a vegan.
Well, I have a lot of respect for vegans, and they're tremendously disciplined. I do find myself difficult to keep the diet. But I do know that we have to do something, and even in veganism, because a lot of the food that they get, even the tofu and stuff, is factory farmed. I think
I know.
My whole thing is sustainability. We have to buy local, keep local, and try to live sustainably within the planet.
Well, you are right about that. But if you do that for fish, for instance, and eat local fish from the North Sea, then there is no sustainable fish. People keep talking about, oh, this is sustainable, this is MSC label. Well, it's not correct, because MSC even labels fish that's been caught with bottom trawling. Mm. And bottom trawling can never, ever be sustainable, because you ruin the complete bottom nature. All the benthic life is killed by trawling in this way. So what can we eat? Yeah, you have to become at least a vegetarian, I think, if you want to be if you want to live a sustainable life.
Well, I agree with that also, but and they show in California, where I'm from, Los Angeles, where they stopped fishing areas around the islands off of California, the fish stocks have come back tremendously just in the last 5 years. So if we do give our oceans a break, that they will come back, and that's what I'm keep telling people.
Yeah,
we got to give them a break.
But we need to give them a long break, and
I agree.
Also depends of the species, you know. Because like in Newfoundland, in Canada, the cod never came back. And it's more than 20 years ago that the moratorium started. They still can't find any cod.
All right, that's covered in my film, the whole cod thing. We call it the cod wars, yeah.
And you've met a lot of...
I've met a lot of fishermen, cod fishermen, and big factory fishermen up close sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I totally disagree with factory fishing. I also tell people that they shouldn't really be eating fish. It's hard to tell them what to eat anymore. But, you know, my belief is like the Hawaiian Islands. When in around the Hawaiian Islands, the priests and priestesses would tell people that this certain water was taboo and you weren't allowed to fish there. And they would make certain waters taboo for 10 years. And if you caught fishing there, you were killed.
Yeah.
Well, after 10 years, they would open that area and make taboo another area, and they actually sustained their fisheries that way. And it seems to me that we should get a little clever, more clever, supposedly, that we're so much more intelligent nowadays.
Yeah, we need protected areas in the ocean like
for
we
sure.
have on land.
Huge amounts.
And at the moment, it's only, it used to be 0.8%, and then the Chagos Islands were protected by Brittany. By Britain,
right.
And now it's doubled. It's 1.6%, but the problem is that nobody checks it.
Well, that's
so
the thing with sea shepherd.
Still fish there.
We're down in the Galapagos Islands, protecting the Galapagos Islands, which is a world site, you know, sanctuary, and they're fishing all over the place. You go to the Cocos Island, and in my film, one time we went to the Cocos Island, there were 15 illegal shark fishing boats within their waters.
I've seen it myself, Peter. I've been diving Cocos Islands. I've been diving Galapagos. You work with Alex.
I do know Alex quite well, yeah. I'm a volunteer for the Sea Shepherd for 30 years.
Okay,
so,
give Alex my best when you see him.
I do know Alex.
Hey, listen, listen, guys, the time is now just ticking over 20 to 9, and I know that Peter's now got to get to his next movie screening, which is happening at 10 o'clock at the Munz. Hey, Doswinkel, thank you very much for joining us here on the show. It's been very insightful. And we hope your time here is all very, very good. Peter and Lon, thank you also very much for joining us here on the show. We're going to have to go to a track and then move on with the schedule. But Alexander, another great score. How do you get them?
Well, they're swimming right around us. You just have to look and open your eyes.
Exactly. So, Dolph,
and go to ITFA.
Thank you very much for talking to us. Yes, fantastic.
Thank you so very much.
You're most welcome.
All right, thanks, guys.
All the best. And good luck with your film, Peter.
Okay, good luck.
Here's the whale. Here's some Electric Six.